A22-1742 and A22-1794 in the matter of the children of AMT and MBB. We can get you to turn on your screens. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you. And Your Honor, I would just indicate that Mr. Brian Choi should be joining us as well, as there's two appellants in this matter.
Thank you. Then we'll wait for Mr. Choi. Ms. Kinsella, are you going to be splitting your time then with Mr. Choi?
Yes, Your Honor, we will be splitting the time.
All right, so we'll, as soon as he sort of turns on, we'll, okie dokie.
I'm here now, Your Honor. I was prohibited from unmuting or turning on my video.
That's quite all right. We are a little ahead of our schedule. I would ask all counsel, are we, I know we're supposed to start at 10:10. We're a little ahead of ourselves. Are we waiting for anyone to watch the video or the argument?
My client will not be watching, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mine will not be watching either, Your Honor.
All right. And Ms. Estep, no one there?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. All right. Then let's get started. As I said, yes.
So the parties are splitting time. But how are they splitting the time?
I can't hear you, Dave. Hello.
How are the parties splitting their time up?
Yes. Is it going to be half and half, 7.5 and 7.5?
Your Honor, I've spoken to Ms. Sinsala this morning. I believe I'm going to allow her 10 minutes and mine 5 minutes. Thank you for checking on that.
Thank you. All right. Then these are two consolidated appeals, A22-1742, A22-1794, in the matter of the welfare of the children of AMT and MBB. The appellants will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. And then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Sinsala, are you going to be splitting your rebuttal time as well, or are you just going to do it all?
Your Honor, we could split the rebuttal time. Perhaps we could make that decision after initial arguments are made.
That's fine. All right. Then, as all parties are aware, the appellants will be splitting their time. And Ms. Sinsala, just please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice when you begin. And then, we'll just set it for 7.5, David.
Thank you. And is the court ready for me to begin?
I think we're just going to make sure that the time is set for 7.5. And so that may take us a little time to jiggle that. So when I see it, we'll get started. Just 1 second there. I think we're almost ready. All right, Ms. Sinsala, whenever you're ready, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Angela Sinsala. I represent the appellant father in this case, Michael Black. Counsel, Your Honors, may it please the court. Mr. Black is a father in this case, and his rights ultimately were terminated by the district court along with the mother's rights. However, in this case, it was in a far different situation than mother. Specifically, Mr. Black, the appellant, did not have an opportunity to prove that he had the ability to parent. And he was never, in fact, found unfit to parent. While the court did make a finding of palpable unfitness, ultimately, I would argue that that was an error and that Mr. Black is not palpably unfit. Throughout the court order,
you argue, as well as Ms. Estep is going to be arguing, that the court relied on subdivision five instead of subdivision four. And I don't know. I'm trying to figure out how you read that into the order, because I read the judge as saying about the presumptions of palpable unfitness, which goes to mom, and I know you represent dad. But the district court went on to say that there had not been a rebuttal of that palpable unfitness, and then goes on to talk about neither parents being able to cognize what they needed to do to care for the child or children. So what is the significance of that when you have the judge talking about palpable unfitness, the statutory adherence?
And Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not quite sure I understand your question. Are you regarding the significance of palpable unfitness as it relates to Mr. Black?
As to Mr. Black, both of you are arguing that the court relied on something that was not pled as far as a basis for the termination. We all know you need to have one basis for termination. And I'm hearing you also say that the court did not determine that your client was palpably unfit. And I'm asking if you're agreeing then that was appropriate as far as the judge to make that consideration. Not that he was, but to go under subdivision four.
Your Honor, I would, thank you. I would argue that it was not appropriate for the court to make that determination regarding palpable unfitness as it relates to Mr. Black.
So you're arguing this case, you're contesting the factual determinations of the court.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you. Throughout the district court's finding, it regularly states, for example, that Mr. Black has a low IQ or is low functioning. And it seems to be that the court is relying on this determination that he has a low intellectual functioning.
Oh, well, we'll be very careful about that, because we clearly understand and agree that low functioning, or the ability of a parent to properly parent, should not be affected by their mental score. But it looked as if the judge in this case noted the deficiencies, that both parents couldn't sense the needs of the children or could not respond appropriately to the children, were consistently late as far as any visitations were concerned. And I know I'm lumping that all in together, and that it primarily reflects on mother's conduct, but father was also a part of that. The father did not understand the importance or the ability to be present for the child. What was your response to that?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just echo the comment that it seems that the court sort of lumped together its comments and its findings as it relates to both mother and father. But the record does support that father actually significantly complied with his case plan, and in fact was able to demonstrate that he was appropriate to parent. For example, he complied with and was successfully, he remained free from any mood altering substances. He completed a chemical use assessment and complied with any and all drug testing that was ordered, and he was successful.
I'm looking at the court order, even as it relates to visitation with the children. And yes, it says Amber and Michael, but it goes through detailed dates: January 4, January 7, January 28. Late. Not understanding or having a recognition that this has to be a responsibility of a parent. Bringing sausages to the center, bringing McDonald's to the center. Late. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that both of these parents dearly love these children, but they don't seem to be able to comprehend the totality of that. I mean, you're not disputing those findings of fact, are you?
I'm not disputing those findings, Your Honor. And I would say that there certainly are some deficiencies on the part of both parents, including my client, Mr. Black, regarding, you know, being a perfect parent. They certainly are not perfect parents. And he certainly was, you know, late. He's got things that would define him as less than perfect. But as the court is well aware, perfection of parenting is certainly not what the standard is. And him being late to these visits doesn't directly correlate to his inability to parent, especially when, for example, he participated in a real care baby simulation, which was an exercise that the county asked for as part of its case plan. And the point of that was to demonstrate and to test his parental skills. And he did very well in that. In fact, he obtained a certificate of achievement for completing the nurturing program through Lutheran Social Services. He successfully complied with the family resource program for in-home parenting skills education. And again, excelled at this real care baby simulation exercise, which is, I think, far more indicative of his actual parenting abilities than whether or not he was on time at the parenting center. Additionally, I would add that if the parenting center notes show that he routinely, that there were no issues noted with him, that he did attend to the children, that he was attentive, that he was appropriate. There were no concerns noted specifically regarding Mr. Black during those parenting time sessions. There were concerns noted regarding mother. And again, I think that the concerns were lumped together by the court and just sort of unilaterally applied to father. But father's position is really very different from mother's. He, other than really being late for some parenting time sessions, there's not a lot that he didn't complete. There's not a lot that they can say.
And again, I go back to the cues and the court's finding that, and again, it lumps both parents. The parents are unable to recognize cues, sleeping, eating, when they experience discomfort. The older boy, and this may be more appropriate to mother, had the continual penile infection that went unattended. We can't discount those findings by the trial court. Is there any, what would be the best evidence of father's ability to parent effectively that you can give us that would override those concerns?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll just respond briefly as I see that I'm out of time. I think the trial record is clear. It has multiple examples that father, in fact, did, for example, feed the baby with the bottle and was appropriate with that. Was appropriate and was able to pick up on the cues of the children. So while the findings say, you know, mother and father were not able to pick up on the cues, I think the record supports that father actually was able to, and that is in particular supported by the parenting center notes and by some of the testimony throughout the trial. So I think the problem or the concern that I have is that there are many findings that really apply to mother and don't apply to father, but were broadly applied to both parents and really, I think, done so in error.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the father, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Brian Toy. I'm the attorney for appellant mother AMB. I'd first like to focus on the issue of rebutting the presumption of unfitness and how that applies in this case. The mother must show that her parenting abilities have improved and that she can successfully parent a child. And that the circumstances have improved, I think, was clearly proven on the record. The circumstances for her prior termination were much different than the circumstances in this case. In that case, she did not have housing. She did not have employment. She did not have a stable relationship. She did not have any support system in place.
Toy, when I read your brief, I thought it was very well done in connection with talking about what mother has overcome. Because I will give you that this child had a special needs issue, the child that was terminated involuntarily. Now she has stable housing. Now she's employed. She's left the abusive dad. But We need to also consider the circumstances as far as mom's conduct. The way I read the involuntary termination is not that it was by default that she just didn't show up. It was by default that she was in the courtroom and had an inability to control her emotions and walked out. And the judge also found in the case supporting TPR for the first child of mother that the cues were missed again, that she didn't recognize the eating or the discomfort. So you have to admit that although it sounds good that mother has achieved quite a bit, that she still has primarily those three things to overcome, those outbursts and inability to read the cues. I mean, do you think she's overcome the outbursts?
Well, I think those are two great examples that somewhat prove my point, Your Honor. She sat through 5 days of trial here with people saying very bad things about her for 5 days, and she didn't walk out. So her maturity level in dealing with social services and dealing with the court was much better here than it was in the case where she stormed out and got the involuntary because she failed to appear for the rest of it. The other thing, Your Honor, with the cues, I really see this as a subjective versus objective evidence. And I come back to that Real Care baby. And when I read this transcript, I was very concerned about how this played out because you have these professionals that all work for the county or for providers that are primarily funded by the county saying that she's not picking up on cues. But when we use an objective basis to determine whether she's picking up on cues, both her and father do very well. And so we also have...
Then we deal with these type of findings from the trial court judge. Mother had to be reminded to make a bottle and take care of the children. Mother did not recognize moving a burning candle from the table that was within reach of the, I believe it was the oldest boy. Mother hollered at dad because he'd lost his keys and did that in the presence of the children. I mean, we have numerous examples of those type of outbursts that the court found inappropriate, and they were the same as they were with child one.
True, but in this case, you have 10 months of every single interaction between mother and child being witnessed by another person and writing down every note. If every single parent had everything they did right or wrong written down on a piece of paper, you'd have every judge being able to fill a couple pages, right? We're not all perfect, but I sort of call it Mary Poppins syndrome. We can't come into this saying, is this a perfect parent? No, it's, is this an adequate parent that can meet the needs of the child? And what I come back and look at is the fact that the youngest child lived with mother and father for the first 14 months of his life. No interaction with the county.
Was the state of California, and he did have the genital infections that seemed to be a recurrent, unresolvable problem. I don't have a question there. You know, here's my question, though. We review the district court findings for clear error, and it's very difficult when we have specific findings to overcome that. Tell us how we can do that in this case and say that there was clear error in making this determination, especially as it relates to mom.
Well, I think you have to look at it again with the fact that, you know, those instances that were noted in the order were brought up by multiple witnesses at the trial to talk about the issue with the candle, the issue with the birthday party. Those are small moments in time. These were parents that were going to all their visits for 10 months. There's a lot of interactions that were never testified to and never talked about. But when you have the objective information from the Real Care baby and from the child, I mean, I know we can say the child was raised in the state of California, but he came into Minnesota as a healthy child for his age. There's no issue that he's behind in learning or that has special needs. So these parents have done, at least for those 14 months. And, you know, the issue with the genital infection, the evidence was also that they took him in to get that looked at. And they did get prescription medication that they were applying. I don't think there was really enough developed there to say that that was due to the fault of the parent. I certainly don't think there was clear and convincing evidence of that. I think that sort of triggered the involvement with Otter Tail County, that and the positive test at a prenatal appointment. And so those kind of tied into the county's involvement, which I certainly understand. But, you know, I think we get too nitpicky into say, oh, at one point in time, she didn't recognize a bottle. Well, I'm sure I did that at some point in my parenting. I mean, I don't see where there's an unresolvable issue, particularly with the father, because I really do agree with Ms. Sansala that it was everything sort of lumped together with mother. But I think that the objective, you know, the issue with the queues to me was resolved by the objective Real Care Baby. And the county's trying to have it both ways there, right? If they would have done poorly on the Real Care Baby, you better believe that would have been exhibit one in the case. But when they did well, and when their parental capacity evaluations outline a system of expanding a visitation, nothing happened. So what was the point, right? The point was to see if they failed. Unfortunately for them, they did very well, but it really didn't lead to any further advancement of the case plan at that point. I just want to make one last point as I'm running short on time. With the palpable unfitness, there was a lot of discussion about my client's mental function, but I don't believe that the record really provided anything other than the fact that she has adequate mental functioning. There was certainly some lay opinion testimony from the workers and some of the other providers that they thought maybe she had low mental functioning, but that was never introduced into the record. So I don't believe that that fact was proven by clear and convincing evidence. And that was a lot of the reasoning behind the court finding that they really weren't going to be able to either rebut the presumption or move forward to a point where they could safely parent the child. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. The agency in this matter, Otter Tail County Human Services, have provided services to this family for an extended period of time. It was noted within the documentation and mentioned by counsel that it was approximately 10 or 11 months by the time the trial in the matter had concluded. And the finding...
I'm going to interrupt you right away since I did the other two lawyers also. So what's the big deal then about you conceding that the agency had not pled one of the factors that the judge relied on? I mean, what's that all about? To me, it just seems like it's a bunch of nothing, but you've conceded it. So tell me why we're even looking at that issue.
Your Honor, the issue was raised within the briefs of the appellants regarding the court's reference to and discussion of subdivision 260C.301 subdivision 1B5. It's noted that within the pleadings by the agency, 1B5 was not part of that petition, and the agency had proceeded under subdivision 1B4 related to that palpable unfitness. Because the appellants had raised the issue that the court had made reference to 1B5 and were making arguments related to whether or not it was appropriate to have findings of that nature or have a determination for a termination of parental rights based on a ground that was not pled. The agency simply agrees or would stipulate to the fact that 1B5 was not pled and is not the sole basis or a ground even in which the court had found clear and convincing evidence to terminate parental rights. I believe that within the court's order, the mention of 1B5 and the review of the reasonable efforts therein was not a specific determinative ground for the termination, that the termination of parental rights for both father and mother were based on 1B4, which was the ground that was pled. But so as not to confuse or allege that 1B5 is a ground upon which the termination took place or should have taken place, we simply acknowledge that 1B5 was not pled as part of those grounds. It was referenced within the court's order, but the position of the respondent is that that reference was made as part of the review in general of the termination of parental rights and the reasonable efforts of the agency to offer services and supports. Ground 1B5 goes through and details reasonable efforts and that despite the efforts of the agency, those conditions could not be remedied. Here again, as I'd stated, 1B5 was not pled, but a review of 1B5 as part of the court's analysis as to the nature and duration of the parent's ability to provide appropriate parenting for the children for the near or foreseeable future would be appropriate. The reference to 1B5, it is the respondent's position was simply as part of the court's review of the entirety of services that were offered, the time frame in which they were offered, the fact that in this matter, the agency had filed a termination of parental rights on an expedited fashion, initially going in to seek to work with the family and to do a CHIPS for compelling reasons, Child Need Protection or Services matter for compelling reasons, initiating a safety plan with the family. However, based upon the circumstances and the very swift, I believe it was a 4-day turnaround from November 5th when that safety agreement was made to November 9th when a determination was made to file that termination for parental rights, the agency had an expedited TPR filing. However, with the ICWA concerns that the Indian Child Welfare Act may apply, the matter was not concluded within the time frame of a swift trial based upon the filings that was extended various times to ensure ICWA compliance, meaning that active efforts and reasonable efforts were provided to the family throughout the course of the matter. I believe that at the time of the end of trial, the older child had been out of home for 354 days, and the younger child who was removed during the matter and included through an amended petition had been out for 302 days. These were extensive days of opportunities for service and the provision of the active efforts of the agency, and then the changeover to a specific requirement of reasonable efforts. Again, noting though that there was no change made to either of those case plans or the services that were offered, the agency continued to maintain the provision of all of those services after that June determination. I believe during the review or the permanency progress review in June, that active efforts were no longer necessary because ICWA had not, on August 3rd, ICWA was determined not to apply. At the June hearing, the court had determined that active efforts were being made while the matter pended for ICWA. And so the court had made findings throughout the matter that reasonable efforts and active efforts were being provided. There were reference in the June review post or permanency progress review that there were missed and canceled visits, ongoing need for direction and instruction on child safety and needs. And this is while the active efforts were being provided. In August, it was determined that ICWA did not apply, finally, after review or receipt of information from the tribes that had been identified. And so then the matter moved forward to trial. But throughout the entirety of that time, up and through the time of trial, the services were being provided to the family, the ongoing visitation, the ongoing supports of the family resource worker and parenting education, and that these services were all being provided to the family at that time. And so to review the reasonable efforts of the agency is part of the analysis of the court in determining the palpable unfitness of the parents and the nature and condition of their parenting to ensure a full review of the record, and that despite all the efforts of the agency, despite the offering of services, despite the parenting education, that the parent's ability to receive that information, to apply those changes, to understand that parenting education component, the child need component, the appropriate parenting of the children and discipline, as well as primarily the largest concern was their safety and preservation, had not changed despite all of those efforts of the agency, which were found to be reasonable, and that they were an ongoing nature, and that the efforts provided by the agency through a large variety of service providers and through ongoing and consistent involvement did not show measurable or demonstrable change by either parent, whether or not a presumption applied. Presumption did apply to mother, a presumption did not apply to father, but neither parent was able to demonstrate that they had the ability to properly parent the children. And that in this case, while the court has indicated and Your Honor had mentioned previously that there have been some instances related to the lumping together or the addressing of parents together, that is to say that many of the conditions or concerns related to both parents, it is not that a finding related to mother was just inclusive of father for no reason that wasn't included within the records.
Here's the parents... question I have to ask because I just plain don't know. Father indicated that he plans on staying married to mother, and that's always a good thing. Marriage is a stability factor. But whatever happens when a court says that you haven't met the burden as far as father's TPR, but father's with mother? I'm not saying we're entertaining this, but I'm just curious how that plays out.
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding in that scenario would be if we had a situation wherein which a parent had been, let's say, when the family moved to Minnesota and had the younger child, and then a birth match flag was raised, because as discussed previously, the first child here was born in California and was not known to the agency. A birth match did not flag in that regard. And so then when they moved over to Minnesota, we were unaware until the reports that had come in. But should there have not been a child protection involvement at all, and the second child was born to these parents, the agency would have immediately received that birth match flag and worked with the family to determine if this was a scenario in which a child protection action for compelling reasons, rather than immediate TPR expedited filing because of that involuntary, would have been appropriate. And so the matter would, I believe, proceed approximately the same. Should this matter go back and there be a finding made that father was not appropriately subject to termination of parental rights and that ongoing efforts should be made, consideration would still need to be addressed as part of that case plan and scenario as to his living situation and the exposure of the children to an inappropriate care provider. That was an issue at this case throughout the entirety of the matter. The parents were not married. I don't necessarily believe they were engaged, but again, I cannot speak to that knowledge specifically. But at the outset of the matter, the only child that was born at the time was that of the parents. However, with the family determining to marry and stay within the home together as opposed to have separate residences, as sometimes happens within these child protection actions, if one parent determines that the other parent is palpably unfit and would not be meeting or overcoming their burden or to be determined to be an appropriate parent, but that they wish to maintain that relationship with their children and to be the parent for the children, they do reside in separate residences. And they make the conscious decision to place those children's needs above their desire for the relationship to ensure that the children's safety is maintained. Sometimes that can be inclusive of a safety plan with the agency creating that child protection action, as we had discussed, and offering services and helping the family to work together to ensure the children's safety. But there are child protection actions that initiate because an individual selected a previously terminated person to be their daycare provider. And in this case, I believe that it was discussed within the record as well that the parent's intention is to stay married and that the father here would remain the primary provider for the family and that they would intend that the mother here would be the sole care provider for the children throughout the day. And in this case in particular, having that prior involuntary termination, having not rebutted the presumption and having, despite the presumption, you know, pretending it did not exist in this case, still being unable to show that she clearly had the ability and the appropriate parenting skills necessary to safely maintain the children within the home, she would not be an appropriate care provider for the father to select to leave the children with. And I believe it was also noted within the record that the parents indicated that they have a lot of family support and individuals that can assist in providing for the care of the children, and that consideration should be made for the option to mitigate their deficits and their inabilities by having additional individuals around. But those individuals are not the parents of the children. They are not available at all times. And the concern also remains that at the time of the removal of the child, the oldest child, the parents were present multiple doors down in a separate apartment with her parents, and had left the older child, who was the only child at that time, and very young, I believe under the age of two, alone in the apartment by himself with no baby monitor that was working for a period of 15 to 20 minutes, I believe. And this was after having, executed the safety plan with the agency. These are also the same individuals that were their support parents or support people that were referenced who were present in hosting the birthday party that was discussed within the record, where in which the case aide had to assist in removing multiple pills and available medications to the children. And so there's a concern there as well that even if the deficits that the parents have demonstrated related to their ability to acknowledge the cues, to understand them and recognize them, and to provide for safety, particularly the transference of safety skills. A hot candle on the table is not something that the child should be told and figure out what to do. That's a parental responsibility to remove. But again, the family resource worker also testified that the transference then of also keeping the child away from a hot stove was never demonstrated. There was an inability to show that the parents' skills that were being specifically addressed through parenting education, through the assistance of the agency, through supervised visitation and skills building were not making markable, measurable changes in their ability, and that those that they were including within their children's lives, again, who all are acknowledged to have demonstrated a lot of love for these children, were still not able to collectively prevent the children from being in situations that were harmful or dangerous, as well as the cues and the clear indication within the record that despite direct provision of direction by individuals, including these parents or grandparents, to not do harmful things, such as spin the hamster ball in front of the child, there was no ability to correct those behaviors of the parents. And that's with direct supervision. Concern for the young children of this age and the inability to notice those cues, provide for safety, to correlate certain safety measures to other dangerous situations. The court had sufficient evidence defined by clear and convincing standard that the parents have been determined palpably unfit and that the termination of parental rights was in the children's best interest.
Thank you very much, Ms. Estep. And then I guess my last question is, do the parties or the appellant's counsel, do you wish to split your time? And if so, how much?
Yes, thank you. We will split our time, and Mr. Choi and I have agreed that I would have 4 minutes and he will have 1 minute.
All right, then just give us a second for the marshal to set that, and then Ms. Ansala, you'll go first.
Thank you.
I think we're ready. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. Ms. Estep made multiple comments about the case plan being sufficient and adequate. And while I understand that the district court made findings that the case plans were reasonable, I think there are several concerns that the record supports regarding specifically the services that were available regarding that case plan for father in particular. For example, I think it's noteworthy that father's family resource worker was not able to commence services until 5 months after the child was removed. Father's clinical interview and ultimately the parental capacity that father was required to do was not finalized for nearly 6 months after removal. And this is important because these were services that the county agency was responsible for setting up. And in fact, Mr. Black was requested to sign a release of information so that the parental capacity could be set up. He did that months earlier, and yet his parental capacity was not set up and was not ultimately done for several months. In fact, there's even testimony during the trial where it states that father's parental capacity was sort of put on hold while mother's parental capacity went forward, and then his was to be scheduled a couple weeks later. And this is important because we look at the timelines and the fact that there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not the parents were able to meet the criteria to safely parent the children. But at the point that father was not assessed and really didn't have meaningful services really put in place for several months after the children were removed, it's concerning. But I would state and say that after services began for father, he very quickly began to show improvement. Father was amenable to, for example, in-home therapy. Once it did get started, in fact, the in-home therapy practitioner testified at court that he would get down on the floor, play with the children. He knew how to change diapers. He would get their food ready, things like that. She testified that he was the one primarily responsible for childcare during the observed visits. She also testified that father is much more engaged, was able to pick up on cues, change diapers. There was an example where there was a puppy in the room, and father saw the puppy being rambunctious, and he quickly picked the puppy up, put it in another room, said that it was too much for the children, and actually made the comment that he may be necessary to get rid of the dog if he's going to hurt the kids. So father picked up on that without anybody telling him to, and he was able to pick up on that cue. There is another instance where mother was wanting to put, I believe, some soda in the child's bottle, and father intervened and said, no, that's not appropriate, and ultimately did not allow the child to have that bottle. So I think that there was marked improvement in father's decision-making, and he was amenable to those services. But unfortunately, those services, quite frankly, he did make significant improvements, but those services were started very, very late for him without any real explanation from the county. I think it's also important to note that father was never subject to a CHIPS petition. And I don't understand, and I think it's noteworthy that the county had the option and could have gone through with a CHIPS case for the father and given him a reasonable plan, but had it be under a regular CHIPS petition rather than a termination of parental rights. But they went straight to a termination of parental rights with mother, which I understand there was that presumption of unfitness, but they did that with father as well. They ultimately did not allow him to engage through a CHIPS petition and a CHIPS case before they went to termination on father. And I think that's concerning and also indicative of the county's intent, that they really had no intent from the beginning to really allow father to prove that he was able to parent these children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nsala. We'll now hear for the final counsel for the appellant, Mr. Tui.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, I want to touch on the discussion about whether father would need to be separated from mother if his termination were overturned. I think that's sort of an unfair discussion to have. You know, those situations often come up in child protection cases, and there are a myriad of safety plans that can address that issue. That there's nothing in the record to indicate that that discussion was had with father ahead of time to say, hey, we would consider working with you if you were separated. And if there's no evidence of that, I don't think that's a consideration the court could make or should take into consideration. The other final issue is the...
In paragraph 18 of the judge's order, he lists that this is based on his inability to provide for the safety of the children or care appropriately for the ongoing physical, mental, or emotional needs of the family due to his intellectual functioning level, inability to understand and meet the children's cues and needs, and his residing with the mother, who is subject to a prior involuntary termination. It does seem to be that the court did consider that as problematic for the father.
And I agree that that's in the order, but I don't believe there was any testimony at trial to prove that that fact is proven by clear and convincing evidence, or that there was ever any discussion from the county with the father to say, you know, if you were living on your own, we would consider placing the child with you. That never happened. And so for the court to say, well, you're living with this person, so therefore your rights should be terminated, I think is unfair. And so when the question was asked to Ms. Estep about whether or not the child could be returned to the father if he was living with mother, and my point was that avenue was never discussed. And so in cases where that is discussed, there's typically a safety plan that's just whether they live separately, whether they have alternative supervision, those sorts of things would generally be in place. But that the record is empty regarding any of those issues. So I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for the appellants. Thank you, counsel, for the respondent. The matter is submitted.